We'd love to help you if that's your need and that's your desire this evening. If this is your first time at Kleinwood, you've never received a visitor's packet, we encourage you to get one. And they're available at all three exits to the auditorium. And in that card, or in that packet, you'll find a card that can be used to tell us about yourself and any spiritual concerns, questions, comments you might have. There's also some good information about the congregation, our meeting times, and what we're about here. And we'd love for you to have that and know us a little bit better as you share a little bit about yourself with us. We're glad you're here this evening. Luke 22 in your Bibles. Let me begin reading down around verse 63. Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him and beating him. And they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, "Prophesy, who's the one who hit you?" And they were saying many other things against him, blaspheming. When it was day, the council of elders of the people assembled, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council chamber, saying, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe, and if I ask a question, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "Yes, I am." And then they said, "What further need do we have of testimony? For we've heard it ourselves from his own mouth." And then the whole body of them got up and brought him before Pilate. They began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man to mislead our nation, forbid us to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him and said, "It is as you say." And Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they kept insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." And when Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he'd wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him and was hoping to see some sign performed by him. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. And Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, but before they had been enemies with each other. So Pilate summoned the chief priests and the rulers and the people, and he said to them, "You brought this man to me as one who incites the people to rebellion. And behold, having examined him before you, I find no guilt in this man regarding the charges which you make against him. No, nor is Herod, for he sent him back to us. Behold, nothing deserving death has been done by him. Therefore, I'll punish him and release him." Now he was obliged to release them at the feast, one prisoner. But they cried out all together, saying, "Away with this man, and release for us Barabbas." For he was one who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection made in the city, and for murder. Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again. But they kept on calling out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has this man done? I have found in him no guilt demanding death. Therefore, I'll punish him and just release him." But they were insistent, with loud voices, asking that he be crucified. And their voices began to prevail. And Pilate pronounced sentence that their demand be granted. And he released the man they were asking for, who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, but delivered Jesus to their will. This is, of course, the story of how Jesus gets crucified. It's familiar to many of us. And it's a disturbing story about human nature, about the group mentality. Everybody is turning against Jesus. Everybody is abusing him. The religious leaders are after him. The political leaders, even though their job is to dispense justice, and even though Herod says, "I find nothing wrong with him," and even though Pilate, three times repeating this to the Jews, "There is nothing deserving of death in him," even they turn on Jesus and sell out to the demands of the people. The guards and the security personnel, they're against Jesus. They use every chance they have to mock him, to beat him, to make fun of him. "Prophesy, who hit you?" if you're so good, if you're such a prophet. Even the common person, the common man or woman on the street, turns on Jesus. Crucify him, they cry. Literally everybody in this point in the story, everybody turns on Jesus. Jesus was killed because they accuse him of blasphemy. He claimed to be God. And that's important. They kill him in a sense that the official cause of death, if you will, for Jesus is not so much for his annoying teachings. It's not so much for his high moral standards. When it comes down to it, what they simply can't stand, where their clothes are ripped, and what absolutely they despise is that he claims to be God. They tell Pilate he claims to be a king. He encourages rebellion. He tells us not to pay our taxes. And so Pilate asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" The Jews say he stirs up the people. He encourages us to be in rebellion. He's a Galilean, Pilate finds out. That means he's Herod's problem. That's good news. Send him off to Herod. Always pass the buck when you can. That's the first law of politics. Nobody can find a real flaw, a true wrong in Jesus. Yes, he claims to be God, and that drives the religious leaders nuts, but he really was God. He is a king. He is a Galilean. But nobody at the end of the day can find a true, real flaw in Jesus. Even after Jesus is misrepresented to Pilate, they say to Pilate, he encourages us not to pay taxes. Jesus said no such thing. Jesus just simply said, give the Caesars what's Caesar's and give the God what's God's. He never said don't pay taxes as such. Even in being misrepresented before Pilate, Pilate at the end of the day, after making his own investigation, admits there is nothing wrong with this man. I want to release him. Justice requires me to release him. And especially in Pilate's effort, his repeated effort to release the man. Herod says, you know, it's fun to make fun of him, especially if he won't work a miracle or show off for me. I'll make fun of him for a while and I'll send him back. Dress him in a robe and send, here's your king of the Jews. Have fun. Pilate, that last vestige of his humanity, knows that this is wrong, that this is unfair, that it is unjust. And so he repeatedly pushes the Jews. And Luke even belabors the point when Barabbas' name comes up. Barabbas actually is exactly what the Jews are accusing Jesus of being. And Pilate knows this, and everyone else knows this. Who is Barabbas? He's the one who's actually encouraging rebellion. That's what it means that he caused an insurrection in the city. He's the one who's actually trying to start a rebellion, a revolution. He is exactly what the Jews are telling Pilate Jesus is all about. And Pilate knows this, and surely the people know this. That's how they know to ask for Barabbas. That's how they know him. How many inmates do you know in the local prison? Everybody knows who Barabbas is. Give us Barabbas, they say. Crucify Jesus. Have you ever thought about it? And I don't mean just in a casual way, but have you ever really thought about the great injustice that this is? Pilate knows it deep down. That's why he resists what the Jews want. He knows that this is unfair and this is unjust. My God, Jesus will say just a short time later from the cross, why have you forsaken me? It is the cry of the pain of injustice. Jesus not only endures the wrath of God on the cross and in his death and in the desertion that he experiences from God. At the cross, Jesus also endures the full evil of what humanity can do and what humanity can be. The rebellion of rejecting God, even if God were one of us. Even if, to use John's language from his first letter, even if we could touch him and handle him and see him and hear him. Even if God was present among us, they reject him. Jesus at the cross not only deals with the punishment for our sin, he endures not just the wrath of God, he also endures the full evil of what the human race is capable of. And therefore, Jesus becomes for us not just an example of obedience to God at whatever the cost, though he is that, but Jesus also becomes for us an example of how to deal with the injustice of life. Absolute, utter injustice, unfairness, when others wrong us grievously. Because I'll tell you, the unfairness of life, when life is unfair, that for a lot of people, that's a real temptation for a lot of people to leave God or to blame God. To steal a phrase from Job's wife, to curse God and die. When life isn't fair, when life is unjust, when things don't go the way they should be. And Jesus becomes for us not just a fantastic and phenomenal example of obedience to God no matter what it may cost us, but he also serves an example for us of how to respond, how to live, how to endure, how to maintain faith in the face of great injustice. Indeed, when the Hebrew writer speaks in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 of Jesus and says, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things as we are, yet without sin." That includes the injustice of life. We read that verse and we think about, well, Jesus had to deal with the temptation to lie, or the temptation, the sexual temptation of the body, or the temptation to have less faith. Jesus had to deal with the temptation to lash back, to fight back, to hit back, to give way to anger, to allow the desire for vengeance to overcome obedience. Jesus has had to face the problem of unjust and unfair suffering, of when others wrong you unfairly, when they misrepresent you and say all manner of falsehood about you. He's had to face the temptation to take vengeance into his own hands, just like you and I do. Jesus has been in the place that we've been, those why God moments when he straddles the chasm of fear and hopelessness and anger and the desire to respond in kind. And so the Bible reminds us of his example, especially how it relates to the issue of unjust, unfair suffering. In 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning in verse 18, Peter writes, the Apostle Peter, to Christians, it says, especially to servants, "Be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. For this finds favor if, for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if, when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God." Here's the counsel of God to those who suffer unjustly and unfairly in life. Slaves, in this particular context, who have an unreasonable and unfair and unjust master. You be submissive in all respect. You do what's right and suffer unjustly if need be. Why? Because this is how the people of God respond, starting with no less than Jesus himself. And indeed, the Apostle Peter, just a little bit in 1 Peter chapter 2, will remind his readers and us of this exact point. The fact of the matter is, when it comes to unjust suffering, we need to remember several things in order to endure well. First of all, we need to realize that when pain comes in our life, especially unjust suffering, when people are cruel, unfair, harsh, when people are just downright evil to us, we need to understand that in a very real sense, suffering and pain and injustice are not unusual. They're normal. You ever think about it that way? It kind of puts the why me feeling in perspective, when the fact of the matter is injustice and unfairness and evil are actually the normal course of life in a fallen world. We live in a fallen world, a very broken world, and we tend to forget that. We tend to forget that because of the curse, creation itself at times works against us. That evil touches the righteous and the unrighteous alike in this fallen world. Genesis 4, the story of Cain and Abel, makes this point as vivid as any. Think about it. What happens in the story of Cain and Abel? Here's the first story of a fallen world. Here's the first story of what the world is like after sin enters into it. After God comes down, sorts things out with Adam, Eve, and the serpent. The very first story to show us what life is like in this newly fallen world is the story of Cain and Abel. And what's the upshot of the story of Cain and Abel? Righteous Abel dies, and wicked Cain continues on and doesn't even care. Abel does nothing wrong. He dies. Cain actually despises him for his righteousness. God accepts his offering, not mine, kills him for it. And Cain, for his part, goes on as though nothing has happened. Even when God asks him what happened, Cain says, "I'm not my brother's keeper. I don't know." When God judges Cain for what he's done, "You're cursed to be a wanderer."
Cain still finds no place for penitence. All he's concerned about is, well, somebody will kill me. I don't want to have happen to me what I did to him. Injustice in a fallen world, suffering and pain, it's not unusual. It's the new normal. It's the way the world works now. We live in a fallen, broken world, and we tend to forget that. And so Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 4, beginning in verse 12, and he says, "Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing. Listen now, as though some strange thing were happening to you." How long have you been living life? How long have you been in the world? It's a tough place. It's a cold, cruel world. God knows that and confesses as much. Don't be surprised, Peter says, when things go badly. It's actually common. The second thing to understand is that what happens to us in this life, the pain, the suffering, the injustice, it doesn't tell us what God is thinking about us. The level of suffering or pain in our life has nothing to do with how God feels us. The temptation for a lot of people, even people I think who know better, but find themselves in those dark corners of the life of life in the world, the temptation is always to begin to think, or at least wonder, is God trying to maybe tell me something through what's happened? Did I maybe do something to deserve this? Suffering does not in and of itself mean God's mad at you. That God's having a temper tantrum and getting even with you. I mean, if nothing else, that's the basic premise of the story of Job, isn't it? That his predicament, horrible as it was, his friends are speechless when they first come to sit with him. As horrible as his predicament was, as staggering as the losses were, his predicament had nothing to do with God's pleasure with him. In fact, the ironic reality is Job is in the predicament he's in exactly because he's such a good person that God and Satan take notice of him and his great righteousness. Jesus suffered. The apostles suffered. The early Christians suffered. Was God mad at all of them? In fact, not only was God not angry with Jesus or with the apostles or with the early Christians, they're often commended by God, even in the midst of their suffering. And we need to remember that, that suffering does not tell us necessarily what God is thinking about us. Hebrews chapter 11, the first part of it's the part we know well. God's people do great things through faith. It's the end of Hebrews chapter 11 that also reminds us, though, that even God's great and faithful people often don't have happy endings to the stories. They have very tragic ends to the stories. Oh, yes, by faith. Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, David, Samuel, the prophets, they by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, from weakness were made strong, became mighty in war, put armies to flight. But others, verse 36, others experienced mockings and scourging, yes, also chains, even imprisonment. They're stoned, sawn in two, tempted, put to death with the sword. They go about in sheepskins, goatskins. They were destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, the Hebrew writer says. People who were too good, too righteous, better than what this world deserved to have in it. Glimmers of hope and joy and right in the world that is so wrong. And yet the Hebrew writer says they had faith, but they still suffered. And the hard truth, we know it, but we need to be reminded of it from time to time, is that it's always an opportunity for growth. Even when the pain or suffering we brought into our own life is our own fault, when we are suffering because we have done unrighteousness, even then, the suffering, it's an opportunity for growth. And that's good news, isn't it? That God can take our sin, our mistakes, as well as the general evil in the world that finds its way into our lives and all the fallenness of the world. And God is so powerful that he can take the bad and make it good. Now, that's not the same thing. This is a very important point because this is where sometimes we get mixed up and people understand the wrong thing or take things the wrong way. This is not the same thing as saying that bad things are actually good. Murder, disease and cancer, pain, death. Those are bad things. What we're saying is that God can bring good out of the bad. Not that, well, your disease isn't what it really looks like. It's actually a good thing. You should be glad you have cancer. That's not the point. The point is that even in the bad thing, God can work a better purpose out of it. That's a crucially important distinction. I mean, after all, if bad things were really good, then why end pain in heaven? That's not the point. But God can take something that is bad and out of the bad, work something good. And so we need to put pain in perspective. Well, what about the place of faith? What role does faith play in all of this? In our language and our culture, all too often, faith, we tell people, just especially when things are going poorly or when they're suffering, we tell people, well, you just need to have faith. And when we talk that way, what we're really doing is we're using faith as a synonym for how we feel. Have faith. In other words, be hopeful, be optimistic. It's the glass really half full, not empty. The way we often in our culture talk about faith has to do with how we feel about things. That we're optimistic and we have hope and we think the best, even in a dark situation. But that's not the biblical view, and the Bible commends faith. Faith has to do with, in the Bible, what we believe to be true, what we accept as true, and then, secondarily, what we do on the basis of what we believe is true. In the Bible, to have faith means to do what is right, even when it makes no sense, even when it's hard, even when we think it's pointless. To do what God says simply because we trust in Him, even though it makes no sense to us. That's the place of faith. Even when it hurts, we do what is right. I love the story in Acts chapter 12. In Acts chapter 12, Peter is in prison. Peter's imprisonment in Acts chapter 12 comes on the heel of Herod's execution of the apostle James. In chapter 12, beginning of verse 1 of Acts, about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church and ordered to mistreat them, and he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. Unjust suffering. James has done nothing wrong. He's just trying to tell the world the truth about Jesus. He's just trying to tell the Jews the truth about Jesus. He's just trying to tell the Romans the truth about Jesus. And they unjustly put him to death for that. But, verse 3, when Herod saw that it pleased the Jews that James had been executed, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. And when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter's kept in prison. Listen now. But prayer for him was being made fervently by the church. Prayer for him was being made fervently by the church. So on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared. A light shone on the cell, and he struck Peter's side, woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly." And his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to him, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow, and he did not know what was being done by the angel was real. He thought he was seeing a vision. And when they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself, and they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod, from all that the Jewish people were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together, and they were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. She recognized Peter's voice. Because of her joy, she didn't open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing at the front of the gate. And they said to her, you ready for this? They said to her, "You are out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so, and they kept saying, "It's his angel." And Peter, in the meantime, he continues knocking. And when they had opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. I love this story. Because here's the thing about this story. Peter expects to die. Peter expects to die. When God sends an angel to rescue, now keep in mind, this is a man who spent years with Jesus. This is a fellow who's seen the power of God made manifest in the world in spectacular ways. This is a man who has been a witness to the fact that God brought a dead Jesus back to life. This is a man who's seen him walk on water. who's seen the transfiguration with Moses and Elijah. This is a man who's seen all manner of the miraculous. And yet that night, Peter expected to die. And even when an angel shows up, he doesn't sit there and say, well, of course. I mean, this is how God works. I've seen this. I've seen less than this before. This is nothing. He thinks it's just a vision. He thinks he's going to die. He's out in the street and the angel's gone before Peter even realizes, I'm free. And then there's his brethren. In verse 5 and then later on toward in the story, twice it's emphasized, what are the brethren doing? They're praying. What do you think they're praying for? Better weather? Into the drought? What are they praying for? They're praying for Peter. And then Peter starts knocking on the door. And Rhoda goes in and says, it's Peter. And they say, no. I know we're praying for him, but he's not here. And she keeps insisting it's him. And they keep insisting it's not. And Peter keeps knocking the whole time at the door. And they're praying. Does that strike anybody as odd? What did they think was going to happen? Why were they praying? Where was this all going? Peter thinks it's a dream. They think their prayers are not going to be answered. So why were they praying? They were praying because God's people are a people of prayer regardless of what happens. Regardless of what we expect to happen. Regardless of what we think God might or might not do in a specific situation. Pray without ceasing. That's the mark of the people of God. Faith is doing what's right even when we don't expect it to work sometimes. In other words, we do the right thing even when we think it's not going to solve my problems. Or because I do what's right and what's good, God's just going to exempt me from the common lot of suffering in this world. I mean, after all, think about the situation. The whole preface to this story is James is dead. So what happened there? The early Christians realized, oh, we should have prayed for him. That would have changed everything. But don't really pray for James? No, James is dead. Peter's about to be dead. They're praying anyways. Because that's what the people of God do. If we think faith is just about being confident in a horrible situation, about being unreasonably optimistic when we have no right to be so, you know what happens to people who think faith is just about being confident? It's just a feeling of hope in light of the inevitable. What happens then is we give up on God and we give up our faith when it doesn't work after all our best effort. If you understand from the beginning that faith and doing the right thing does not get us to the good automatically, does not solve all our problems inherently, we can maintain our faith because we weren't necessarily founding our faith on the expectation that just because we have faith and do the right thing, all the problems are going to go away. They prayed because it was the right thing to do. They prayed because God was in control. They didn't pray because their faith necessarily depended upon Peter's literal deliverance. Do you see that? Because they understood faith doesn't necessarily keep us from suffering. What faith does is faith points us in the right way during the bad times. And so when times are bad, what do? They prayed. They entrusted themselves to God regardless of what happened. Why? Simply because God's people lean upon Him when times are at their worst. Because as they gathered that night and they prayed to God, what they are saying to the world is, no matter what you do to me, no matter what injustice or unfairness, no matter what you vent against me, what you do to me, you will not stop me from doing what is right. And so they prayed that night, even though apparently none of them expected Peter to actually show up at the door. And even Peter didn't expect to escape. So practically speaking, what do we do? Again, not because we don't know this, but because we need to be reminded of this, because anger is such a strong emotion. Our sense of justice and the need to respond when life is unjust is so powerful. What do we do when injustice is having its way, when we have been wrong? Three quick observations will be done. Number one, always, always, always resist the urge for vengeance. Let me tell you, when we recognize that the world is broken, it's fallen, that unjust suffering is not unusual, it's the natural order of things in the fallen world because sin has been let loose and so many of us have chosen to participate fully in it. when we accept the fallen brokenness of the world, when we have the right faith perspective, that you do what's right simply because it's right, simply because you must depend upon God because there is nowhere else to go. When we understand these things, then how the Bible calls upon us to respond to injustice makes sense. And we're actually empowered to live this way because we recognize that rather than God being deaf to our cries and not caring about our predicament, God instead is saying, listen, you just wait and continue to have faith and trust in me. And I, in my own time, and in the way that you can't even touch or fathom, will set things to right. In the meantime, you resist the urge for vengeance. Never repay evil for evil. Because I'll tell you, the problem with vengeance that God so well understands is that once you enter into the economy of vengeance, there is no escape, there is no exit. You ever think about this? The problem with vengeance is that especially when two people are responding with worldly values and worldly ways, when two people are working in the economy of vengeance, the accounts are never settled. Think about it. Road rage. First driver cuts somebody off. So the driver who's cut off, the second driver, he decides to pull around and pull back in front of him and slam on the brakes. And the first driver says, all right, you got me. You know what? We're even now. That's how it works, right? No. The first driver now, he either taps him with his bumper. I don't commute much, but is that how it works? Or gives him a gesture, and it's not a wave. Second driver doesn't like that at all. He saw that in his rearview mirror. He doesn't like that at all. So now he will roll down the window and pull alongside and yell something. And it's not have a nice day. You see what happens? In vengeance, whatever it is, road rage, anything else, in vengeance, the account is never satisfied. When two people enter into this type of a relationship, the problem with retaliation is that nobody ever gets to even. You pay me back, and the way I see it is not now we're even. What I see is now I owe you one, and on it goes. And so what Peter tells Christians who suffer unjustly in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, beginning. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his footsteps. And here's the example. He committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. He does nothing to deserve this. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. He didn't get even. When suffering, he uttered no threats. He didn't pay him back. But entrusting himself to him who judges righteously, that's what he does. He entrusts himself to the God who will judge, who will set things right. Resist the urge to personally retaliate. That's the moral of the story. If Jesus, the only perfect person there's ever been, finds no place for vengeance in the moment of his greatest suffering, who are you or I who frankly have not fully suffered for what we have done in life, to be honest? Who are you or I to try to execute our own version, our own brand of justice in this life? Paul says in Romans 12, beginning verse 17, never, you hear that word? That's a strong word. Never pay back evil for evil to anyone. That's a simple and short sentence, but do you hear the power of those words? Never, Paul says, pay back, get even with anyone. In fact, in verse 18, he goes on to say, if possible, so far as depends upon you, be at peace with all men. Now, we don't have time to trace this all the way down tonight, but the point of this is not that there is never even room for justice in this life. The government, Paul makes very clear elsewhere in Romans 13, is God's tool for justice in this life. But no individual on their own authority has the right to force the issue of justice. That's what God teaches, to resist the urge to vengeance. Number two, always try to be part of the solution. That's what Paul's getting at. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men. Blessed are the peacemakers, Jesus says. Blessed are those who, just like God and Jesus, do their best to solve the problem rather than continue it. And so Jesus suffers unjustly. Everybody in the story turns against him. All manner of untruth is spoken about him. All manner of injustice is committed against him. And yet at the cross he says what? Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Always try to be part of the solution. That's how Jesus suffers, even when it's the most unfair. And so must we. And finally, do you have enough faith to just let God handle it? Do you really trust God enough that his timing and his way of setting things right will be better than anything you can do? Any puny vengeance you might mete out? If what you're really about is true justice being accomplished, then let the one who is the very definition of justice handle it. Peter says of Jesus, he kept entrusting himself to him, listen now, who judges righteously. You know what the problem is with you and I's vengeance? You and I are not wise enough, knowledgeable enough, aware enough, or powerful enough to give true justice. Even the government, which Paul makes very clear in Romans 13, has been empowered by God to be the dispenser of justice in this world. How often does the government get it right? I'm not just talking about our own. Any age, any era, any culture, any country. How often does the government truly serve as a good standard of justice? That's not how it works. And so you and I, ladies and gentlemen, we need to be very, very careful here. Because if what you're about is true justice, the correct answer to the problem of your suffering or others whom you witness, then let the one who alone who can judge righteously handle it. And if you do that, you can rest assured that justice will be given. Because part of justice is the right time. And part of justice is the right way. And part of justice is taking the right circumstances into account. And who are you or I to actually pretend or claim that we have that kind of cosmic knowledge and power to give cosmic justice? He suffered oh so unfairly, the Bible says, but he entrusted himself to the God who alone can give righteous judgment. Wherever you're at this evening, maybe you're hurting tonight. Maybe it's self-inflicted. Maybe it's because life is cruel and unfair and hard. The Bible never says otherwise. We just think it does. Whatever it is that's on your mind and on your heart tonight, lay it at the foot of the cross. Bring it to Jesus. If it's forgiveness of your sins you need, come forward this evening and we'll be happy to take your confession from your heart full of faith, your belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. You make that good confession, repent of your sins, we'll baptize you for forgiveness of your sins this evening. And you can wait the day of judgment, knowing that you'll be on the right side of God's ledger, because God's righteous judgment is also mingled with his infinite mercy. And you can enjoy mercy rather than judgment this evening. You're here tonight, you're a child of God already, but you recognize that the way you're living has put you on the wrong side of God's judgment, and you want to fix that tonight. You're a child of God who has forfeited their birthright as an heir of God. Pray to God for forgiveness, however you failed him tonight. We'd be happy to work with you on that as well. We can pray with you, if we can encourage you, if you just need somebody to know where you're at and what you've done.